Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
South Sudan frees political detainees, and the UN scales up aid operations. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. South Sudan's government says it has freed four political detainees accused of plotting a coup in a bid to revive peace talks with the opposition. Their detention has been a major obstacle in talks between President Salva Kiir's government and rebels loyal to his former vice president, Riek Machar. In an interview with VOA, the presidential spokesman said rebels could no longer use the detention of the alleged coup plotters as a pretext to stall the negotiations. The government detained the political leader shortly after President Kiir in December accused Machar of attempting a coup. United Nations aid agencies are scaling up humanitarian operations in the Central African Republic as the rainy season takes hold of the country. Lisa Schlein reports.
The onset of the rainy season in the Central African Republic is intensifying the vulnerability of some 400,000 internally displaced people who are dependent upon life-saving international aid. As roads become impassable, humanitarian agencies are having greater difficulty reaching many of these desperate people, and the dangers have not gone away. The Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports confrontations between armed troops and direct attacks on villages over the past week in the central part of the country have caused more than 5,000 people to flee their homes and seek shelter in religious sites. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President Barack Obama and his South Korean counterpart, Park Geun-hye, are warning North Korea against conducting another nuclear weapons test. During a joint news conference in Seoul today, Mr. Obama said Pyongyang would get nothing except further isolation if it proceeds with a fourth nuclear test.
Further sanctions that have even more bite, as well as highlighting some of the human rights violations that make North Korea probably the worst human rights violator in the world.
The president added that America's commitment to South Korea will never waver, and the U.S. and South Korea will stand shoulder to shoulder against North Korean provocation. The South Korean leader said Mr. Obama's visit sends a firm message that North Korea's provocations will not be tolerated. Work on Cambodia's secretive cyber crime law has been going on behind closed doors for 2 years, with the government so far refusing any input from civil society groups. Recently, though, a copy of the draft was leaked. Robert Carmichael reports.
Britain-based information freedom group Article 19 has released a scathing assessment of Cambodia's draft cybercrime law. The group said measures in the bill fall well below international standards, threatening freedom of expression in Cambodia. The draft law, on which work started 2 years ago, has assumed increasing relevance since July's general election, which the ruling Cambodian People's Party, or CPP, narrowly won, taking around half the vote and 68 of Parliament's 123 seats. The CPP has for years benefited from exerting complete control over all local television, along with most radio stations and newspapers. Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
The Syrian government is accused of launching airstrikes on a market near the city of Aleppo, killing at least 27 people and wounding several others. Activist groups, including the Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, say government jets hit the crowded market in the town of Atareb, located in Aleppo province, on Thursday. The strikes are the latest in the Syrian government's bombing campaign against rebel-held areas in Aleppo that began in December. Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk is accusing Russia of wanting to occupy Ukraine militarily and politically. It comes as both Kiev and Moscow mass troops close to their mutual border. Mr. Yatsenyuk warned today that Russia's actions could lead to a wider military conflict in Europe. U.S. President Barack Obama says it may be time for a pause in Middle East peace talks while both Israelis and Palestinians consider their options. Mr. Obama told reporters today in Seoul during a visit to South Korea that it's still in the interest of both sides to seek peace, but that neither side has shown the political will to make tough decisions. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Swuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
United Nations aid agencies are scaling up humanitarian operations in the Central African Republic as the rainy season takes hold in that war-torn country.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, a court in South Sudan has freed four prominent men who had been charged with rebellion and treason. And a new UN report names 21 countries where rape and sexual violence are widespread.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Lesotho, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, United Nations aid agencies are scaling up humanitarian operations in the Central African Republic. This as the rainy season takes hold in the country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The onset of the rainy season in the Central African Republic is intensifying the vulnerability of some 400,000 internally displaced people who are dependent upon life-saving international aid. As roads become impassable, humanitarian agencies are having greater difficulty reaching many of these desperate people, and the dangers have not gone away. The Organization for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports confrontations between armed troops and direct attacks on villages over the past week in the central part of the country have caused more than 5,000 people to flee their homes and seek shelter in religious sites. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says access to these areas is limited.
One area where access has actually improved slightly is in Boda, where we've been able to provide additional relief for 24,000 vulnerable people. There's been food distribution, medical, nutrition, non-food item, and wash support. Has been provided.
Despite the security risks, the World Food Programme says it has managed to distribute food to more than 140,000 people this month. In anticipation of the rainy season, WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers tells VOA the agency began pre-positioning food early this month and, in conjunction with the Food and Agriculture Organization, has started to distribute seeds and tools to help farmers plant their crops.
In parallel, WFP provide food ration to the same people so that they do not have to eat the seeds for the agricultural season. Most roads are impassable, and the people, thousands of people, will be in need of assistance. That's why it was very important to start those distribution as early as possible.
She says WFP will continue to scale up its operation. The UN Children's Fund reports the number of children being treated for severe acute malnutrition in Bangui's largest hospital has tripled compared to last year. UNICEF estimates 28,000 children will suffer from this worst form of malnutrition this year. It says it is ramping up its nutritional treatment program to keep these children alive. UN agencies say their efforts to address the country's humanitarian crisis is hampered by a serious lack of money. And they note that only 28% of the international appeal for $551 million in funds has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In South Sudan, a court has freed four prominent men who had been charged with a rebellion and treason following the outbreak of fighting in the country last December. The court said charges were being dropped in order to promote peace and reconciliation. Among those released is Pagan Amoom, a former secretary general of the ruling party. The French press agency quotes him as saying the four men were imprisoned without any reason. In a speech to supporters outside the court, Amoom promised to work to end the fighting. Others released are former national security minister, a former ambassador to the U.S., and a former deputy defense minister. border. Also in South Sudan, the UN mission reports a barge convoy carrying food, aid and fuel came under attack yesterday. Four people were wounded by gunfire and rocket-propelled grenades. None of the injuries is reported serious. The barges were fired upon while traveling on the Nile River to Malakal. The UN mission says it does not know who attacked the convoy.
Well, more than 20 people are reported dead in southwestern DRC following a stampede at a music festival. The Associated Press says panic broke out around 2 a.m. local time when generators failed at a stadium in Kikwit and the lights went out. One witness described what happened as total confusion when everyone tried to flee. Kikwit is the hometown of Jean-Baptiste Emenya, also known as King Kester Emenya. He died in February, and the festival was being held in his honor. Police say they're investigating why the generators failed.
The UN has released a new report naming 21 countries where rape and sexual violence are widespread. It says many of the attacks occurred during current or former conflicts. The countries include Central African Republic, Angola, Guinea, Liberia, Libya, Sierra Leone, Somalia, and Sudan, as well as Syria and Afghanistan. The report blames 34 armed groups for the sexual violence. These include militias, rebel groups, and government forces. Rape has become a weapon of war to intimidate populations and control territory. The UN Special Representative on Sexual Violence in Conflict, Zainab Hawa Bangura, says perpetrators rarely face justice and victims fail to get the social and psychological help they need.
Past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The summit on protecting the world's oceans ended today with a call to tackle the major threats of climate change, overfishing, habitat loss, and pollution. The Global Oceans Action Summit for Blue Growth and Food Security was held in The Hague. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
A joint initiative on ocean health was announced by the Netherlands, the summit host country, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Bank, and summit organizers. Valerie Hickey of the World Bank says the summit was a success.
I think this was the first time that over 600 people came together to align agendas across the conservation and growth fields to discuss how can we actually commit to action to support broad-based blue growth, food security. This was about making sure that we can invest in the oceans in a way that alleviates poverty, that shares broad prosperity while turning down the heat.
Hickey is the World Bank's sector manager for agriculture and environmental services. She says broad agreement was possible at the Ocean Summit, unlike many summits on climate change.
This was the Global Oceans Action Summit. This was not an intergovernmental summit where we were negotiating text. This was an opportunity for the over 80 ministers, leaders from the private sector and civil society to sit down together and make commitments to real action in real time. This was an opportunity to take our hats off, to not speak simply from government positions, to move beyond our positions and start talking about real commitments in real time.
She says agreement was reached on a three-part approach to protecting the oceans. The first would set up partnerships.
We need to bring in the private sector. We need to increase our investments in small and medium-sized enterprises because at the end of the day, it's local communities, it's family fishers, it's small-scale fishers who are going to drive broad-based blue growth in the ocean space. We also talked about governance. We talked about the fact that we need to accelerate actions to make sure we can eliminate illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing.
The third part of the strategy, she says, calls for financing from new places and new partners to support blue growth programs. Hickey says she's confident these recommendations will move from commitment to action.
Absolutely. I can say personally that we as the World Bank are committed to following up on the actions that we promised to do after the summit. It includes helping countries to undertake natural capital accounting of their ocean resources so they can begin to realize real returns from their ocean assets in a sustainable way, in a broad-based way that returns benefits to those local local communities and small-scale fishers who rely for food security, for their livelihoods, for their income on the oceans.
Also commenting on the outcome of the Ocean Summit was Netherlands Agriculture Minister Sharon Dijksma, the chair of the summit. She says the world community has shown courage and boldness to move ahead and take action on ocean health and food security. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Efforts to crack down on Islamists continue in Nigeria. The group Boko Haram has been waging a campaign of violence to impose Sharia or Islamic law. The four-year-old insurgency has claimed an estimated 4,000 lives. Last week, at least 200 students were kidnapped from the government girls' secondary school in the town of Chibok. So what is the latest on the status of the kidnapped girls? My colleague Ashanafi Abeje posed the question to Elizabeth Donnelly, a research fellow and assistant head of the Africa program at Chatham House in London.
It seems that the majority of the girls still missing. The latest is that 50 or so escaped, but the whereabouts of the others is still unknown.
And is there evidence that Boko Haram is in fact responsible for the kidnapping?
It is most likely, yes, that this is a Boko Haram attack. Simply the nature and scale of the attack means that it's most likely the militant group, simply because they would need the transportation and the weaponry to carry out such an attack.
Now, we hear some parents of these children traveled by motorcycle more than 50 kilometers into the Sambisa forest seeking to locate their children. We're told that they turned back because they were told it will be too dangerous, too risky for them to venture deeper into the area. What are the security concerns in those northern states that would frustrate these parents to lead them to attempt taking the law into their own hands?
Well, it's a real sign, I think, of the desperation of the parents that they're making this journey, that they're seeking to go into the forest themselves to look for their children. This really shows the lack of trust they have in the security services in rescuing their daughters, and they feel that it's something that they would have to do for themselves. Because they would also know just how lethal, how violent Boko Haram is. Boko Haram is not a group that negotiates. Boko Haram has spent months, years rampaging, killing civilians. So it is a real risk to the parents. It's also, once they reach the forest, it's very difficult to navigate. It would be a real surprise if they themselves would be able to locate their children, but it's a real sign of their desperation.
Does the government actually have the capability to find these girls and return them to their families?
Well, I would say it does have the capability, but there are two different things here, two different challenges. One is locating the girls, which is a more difficult challenge for the Joint Task Force because of the terrain, because the group has taken the girls into this forest. So it's harder to locate them. They wouldn't be able to use air power to do so, for example. The second challenge is, once they locate them, would be how to rescue them safely, how to rescue them without putting their lives at risk. It's not to say that the Joint Task Force is necessarily short on equipment, but it is, in many respects, part of the difficulty in dealing with Boko Haram is that it's a new kind of threat for Nigeria and for its security services. And the second thing is the strategy. This is a situation in which the forces would have to prioritize protection, in a sense, over attack. At this moment, if this is a rescue operation, it's very much about focusing, prioritizing the girls rather than killing members of Boko Haram. So it's quite a distinction there for the Joint Task Force to grapple with.
Now, the president met with the 36 state governors on national security issues. What do we know about the political position of the governors of the three northern states where Boko Haram seeks to create an Islamic state?
Well, in Borno State and Yobe State, you have governors who belong to opposition parties. Now, what is significant about the emergency rule that has been in place for almost a year now is that ordinarily it would mean that governors are removed from their positions of power. This hasn't been the case so far under this emergency rule, which I would argue is a positive, but there are certainly complex politics at play here, particularly with an election coming up in 2015. But I'd say the state governors have played a really significant role in terms of engaging with the Joint Task Force force on the ground and providing that kind of support. Of course, there are elements, and it's a matter of debate, certainly in Nigeria, of the extent to which there's significant role for good or for ill, but state governors do hold significant weight in Nigeria.
In the past, the presidency, as you know, has rotated between northerners and southerners, but the rules governing that were changed by President Jonathan. Does the violence in the north have anything to do with whether the president hails from the north or the south?
This Boko Haram-related violence does not. It's important to note that the group really emerged as a violent organization under the rule of President Yar'Adua, who, of course, was a northern president. I think it would be a mistake to think that if a northern president were to win the election in 2015, that the Boko Haram crisis would go away. Leadership is certainly relevant here. Who is president does matter. But it's not about where the president comes from necessarily. It's about the statesmanship of the president. It's about the president's capacity to lead effectively, to deal with this crisis effectively. Boko Haram has never stated that it wants to see a northern president in Nigeria. Boko Haram's stated aim is to carve out an Islamic state for itself under pure Sharia law. So I don't think that this crisis should be viewed in those terms.
Elizabeth Donnelly is a research fellow and assistant head of the Africa program at Chatham House in London. She spoke with VOA's Asha Nafia Bejep.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A court in South Sudan has freed four prominent men who had been charged with rebellion and treason. And the UN has released a new report naming 21 countries which rape and sexual violence is widespread. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A revolutionary new drug regimen to treat tuberculosis is advancing to a phase 3 clinical trial by the end of the year. Researchers for the nonprofit group TB Alliance say they are thrilled with the promises it holds for drug-sensitive and hard-to-treat MDR-TB cases. It would slash treatment time from years to months and reduce the number of pills that patients has to take. Also, it does not require any injections, which are painful for many people. The new regimen will have the potential to cut treatment costs by as much as 90%. Dr. Dan Everett is the senior medical officer at TB Alliance. He spoke with me about the significance of the promising new treatment.
Historically, TB's been treated by a group of drugs together, a regimen. One needs more than one. And this is a completely new regimen. It's three drugs. One of them is a brand new drug that's never been on the market for anything. The other is an antibiotic that has been used for other conditions but not approved for TB. And the third is pyrazinamide, which is a TB drug that's been used for some time. And one of the most unusual and really big steps forward of this three-drug regimen is they can be used in patients who have what's traditionally known as routine drug-sensitive TB, as well as patients who have TB sensitive to these drugs, who are traditionally called multi-drug resistant TB. So the one regimen can be used for both groups of TB, and that's a big step forward in that traditionally patients with multi-drug resistant TB need treatment for anywhere from 18 months to 2 years.
What countries will be participating in this trial?
This fall, we're starting what's known as a phase 3 study. So that's the big study just before getting approval to actually market the combination. And this study will enroll a bit over 1,500 patients in 50 different research sites, hospitals and clinics, in about 10 different countries around the world. So we will be in South America, both Peru and Brazil, as well as Haiti in the Caribbean, and then in Africa, in a number of East African and Southern African countries. Will be up in the Eastern Europe and the countries of the former Soviet Union, Russia, Ukraine, and the Republic of Georgia, and then in Asia and the Pacific.
What type of confidence do you have in this new drug regimen?
Once we start the trial, we will be enrolling patients over about a year and a half. And then, of course, they need follow-up. They need treatment and follow-up, which adds about another year to it. So we will finish up the study and get results late in 2017. And then, assuming it's successful, we will apply to the various country regulatory authorities for registration and approval to actually market it in 2018.
How is this trial being funded?
We're confident. We are hearing this week that the Gates Foundation is committing a substantial amount of funding to this, but we are looking also for other funders to complete the funding. One way or another, we're confident we will have the funding to move forward and start the trial, but we are trying to still assemble further funding from a variety of donors in addition to the Gates Foundation.
What makes this drug regimen so unique?
This regimen, assuming it's successful, can be used, again, for patients with drug-sensitive tuberculosis. There currently is a six-month treatment that includes four drugs for the first 2 months and then two of those drugs continuing for four more months. When people take that, every pill all the way through for 6 months, that's quite effective. But many people start feeling better and stop taking it earlier and then end up later with multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. So certainly this regimen will apply to these people. The hope is that it will be a four-month regimen so that they will be cured in 4 months rather than the current 6 to 9 months. For patients with multidrug-resistant TB, those are the ones that could benefit the most in that currently they're required to take 18 to 30 months worth of treatments, and it's often 6, 7, or 8 different drugs at a time. It's been calculated that over the course of their treatment, they take about 12,000 pills, tablets, plus they have to have daily shots that can be painful for up to about 6 months. So to be able to replace that with what for the multidrug-resistant patients would be 6 month treatment of just 3 oral drugs would be a huge step forward. The other thing is for the multidrug-resistant patients, currently the research suggests that only a little over half of them, 53% of them, actually complete the full course of treatment. And for the ones that don't, what happens is often their TB comes back worse with more drug resistance and even harder to treat. So again, the hope to have a 3-drug regimen that can completely treat these people in a 6 month period, you know, would be a major step forward for them.
That was Dr. Dan Everett, Senior Medical Officer at TB Alliance. He spoke with me from New York City.
The Australian naval vessel has seized more than a ton of heroin from a small sailing boat off the coast of Kenya. Officials say the warship, the HMAS Darwin, was patrolling the Indian Ocean and intercepted the Dow Wednesday, about 27 nautical miles from Mombasa. Reuters reports the heroin is worth nearly $270 million. Officials say the drugs may have been destined for Europe. Australian defense officials describe it as a major heroin seizure, saying the drugs could have funded terrorist and criminal networks. The Darwin is part of the Coalition of Maritime Forces, or CMF, that patrols the region to deter piracy and smuggling. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is Sunday Shomari, new host of our lighthearted program, Let's Talk, starting Monday, April 28th, for a show filled with conversation, banter, music, and a whole lot more. Join Let's Talk with me, Sunday Shomari, Mondays starting April 28th at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. We'll be right back.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. United Nations aid agencies scale up humanitarian operations in the Central African Republic. A court in South Sudan frees four prominent men who had been charged with rebellion and treason. And a new UN report names 21 countries where rape and sexual violence is widespread. Coming up, we'll have music from Lesotho, and in our feature segment, a children's charity in South Sudan. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehaya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Happy Friday, Sonny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sonny, I understand Ivory Coast football talks or kicks off your sports report today.
Kim, Africa's highest-ranked football team, Ivory Coast, is preparing for its third consecutive World Cup appearance. The elephants of Ivory Coast are grouped with Colombia, Greece, and Japan for the first round of Brazil 2014. Let's take a look at their schedule. The Elephants will kick off their World Cup campaign against Japan on June 14th in Recife, Brazil. Then they will play Colombia June 19th in Brasilia. And Ivory Coast will wrap up group play against Greece June 24th in Fortaleza, Brazil. Ivory Coast was not able to get past the first round in its two previous World Cup appearances. I asked my Ivorian colleague, Lenor Madu, about the chances of the elephants advancing in Brazil.
I think they have a strong chance to get out of this group. Ivory Coast, the elephants, it's a very, very good team. And one African team that many people agree is very strong. We have to remember in the past, with the past World Cups in 2006, they were in a pool with a team like Argentina. In 2010 in South Africa, you had Brazil in their group. I think that this year, they have a better chance as opposed to before. Colombia is definitely a strong team and the favorite, as many people say. With regards to Japan and Greece, I think that they have an equal chance at making it to the next step.
Lenor, who are some of the key players on the elephants of Ivory Coast?
Of course, I have to start with the captain, Didier Drogba.
Hi, Didier Drogba, striker from Ivory Coast.
Didier Drogba has led this team for several years now, and he has shown that he has been a very, very good soccer player with his past performances. We've seen what he has done with Chelsea. Now he's in Turkey with Galatasaray. And now we think that as a captain this year, he has a lot to prove. This might be his last World Cup because he's now 36, and I think he's going to give it his all. We also have, of course, Yaya Touré, who is the African Football Player of the Year.
Great player.
A great player. Yaya Touré is definitely a strong player in the team, a very good midfielder. And we also have Didier Zokora, who is also a midfielder, to count on. Yaya and Didier make a very good duo when they are on the field, so we definitely have to watch for them. And someone that I want to mention is one of the youngest of the team. He's 21. His name is Serge Aurier. Not very well known, but he's making stride in Toulouse. He plays in a French team, Toulouse, and I think that he's someone to watch in this World Cup.
Lenor, as we talk, Yaya Touré has 18 goals in the English Premier League. One of the top goal scorers.
Absolutely.
You think we're going to see some more goals from Yaya in Brazil?
Of course. I think we will see some goals from Yaya Touré. He has something to prove. He has to show that he is one of the best African players, and he's really a very good player. He has been very strong. He started in 2000 playing soccer in Côte d'Ivoire in the team ASEC Mimosa, and since then he has been very consistent in terms of showing that he's a good soccer player. I think we have to watch for Yaya Touré with the goals, and of course Didier Drogba always there with the last goal when you the least expect it. So.
Finally, Didier Drogba, such an inspirational captain for Ivory Coast. Is this the World Cup, in some sense,
maybe his swan song, Lenore?
I guess in a way it's a bit emotional because, as I said earlier, I think this might be his last World Cup. And given that he's 36, in 4 years he will be 40, he might come back. I think he's still in good shape, right? But we're going toward the end as a captain. And he has something to prove. He has, unfortunately, he has not been very lucky to take the team to winning an international competition, given the Africa Cup of Nations that Cote d'Ivoire has never won under his leadership, and of course the World Cup that we haven't even passed the first step. So I think this is it for Didier Drogba. He has something to prove, and not only him, but the team also has something to prove. Cote d'Ivoire has a strong team. Individually, we have very, very good members in the team. But as a team, we just have to prove that collectively, we can also be strong and win something. And this is maybe not this World Cup, but at least we have to move past the first step.
Lenore Madu, our special guest. Right here.
Thank you, Sonny.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
More Ivory Coast football news now, and this item concerns a striker nicknamed the Gentle Giant for his 2.03 meters tall frame. I'm talking about 23-year-old Lassina Traore, one of the tallest professional footballers, who is currently on loan with Everton in the English Premier League from AS Monaco. Everton club officials say they are open to extending Traore's loan period, even though he's played very little for the English club because of a season-ending hamstring injury. Everton's Spanish manager, Roberto Martinez, says Lassina is recovering well, and clearly he'll be fully fit for the World Cup in June if he's selected for the Ivory Coast team. The Gentle Giant has played for Ivory Coast on its under-23 team, and Lassina was also selected for last year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament in South Africa, but this would be his first World Cup appearance should Ivory Coast's French manager, Sabri Lamouchi, decide to include him. In African club football, one of Ivory Coast's top sides is in action this weekend in the CAF Confederation Cup tournament. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, runs down the fixtures for us.
Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa welcomes South Africa's Kaizer Chiefs as Morocco's Difa Hassani Jadida hosts Egypt's El Ahly in Orange Africa Confederation's Cup action tomorrow Saturday. Tunisia's Bizertin plays Zambia's Nkana, while in an all-Malian affair, Joliba face AS Real de Bamako. Elsewhere, Angola's Petro Atletico encounter Cameroon's Cotton Sport. Ghana's Mediama play Congo Brazzaville's AC Leopards, Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel engage Guinea's Horoya, and Nigeria's Bielsa face Ivory Coast's Sewe Sports. In Egypt, the draws for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers take place in Cairo on Sunday. Preliminary round ties take place in July, with the main group qualifiers expected to run from September to November.
This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Meanwhile, Uganda's world marathon champion Stephen Kiprotich is favored to emerge Nile Special Uganda Sports Press Association, USPA, Sports Personality of the Year at the award gala in Kampala tomorrow Saturday. Kenya's world and Olympics 3,000-meter steeplechase champion Ezekiel Kemboi is a special guest at the annual function. Finally, Athletics Federation of Nigeria staged their second Golden League meeting at the University of Ilorin in Kwara State, Southwest Nigeria tomorrow Saturday. yesterday. Home-based Nigerian athletes who have been in residential training since last year are vying for the qualifying standards for the British Commonwealth Games and the Africa Senior Athletics Championships later this year. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend.
This is Africa.
I'm very, very excited. Because
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
They're playing back.
The National Basketball Association playoffs continue later Friday night with three first-round games. Here in Washington, just a few blocks from our Voice of America headquarters, my beloved Washington Wizards will host the Chicago Bulls. The magical and surprising Wizards hold a 2-0 lead in the best-of-7-game series. Go Wizards! Remember, VOA basketball fans, throughout the NBA playoffs, the first team to win 4 games in each series advances. In New York City, the Brooklyn Nets are at home against the Toronto Raptors. This series is tied at 1-1. And out in the American Northwest, the Portland Trail Blazers will host the Houston Rockets. Portland holds a 2-0 lead in this series. In NBA playoff action Thursday night, the Atlanta Hawks spread their wings and soared past the visiting Indiana Pacers 98-85. The Hawks now lead this series 2-1. Atlanta guard Jeff Teague tallied a game-high 22 points and 10 assists for the Hawks. Also in the American South, the Memphis Grizzlies got past the visiting Oklahoma City Thunder 98-95 in overtime to take a 2-1 lead in their series. Point guard Mike Conley led the Grizzlies with 20 points, while Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook each scored a game-high 30 points for the Thunder. Finally out west in a matchup between two California-based clubs, the Los Angeles Clippers edged the host Golden State Warriors 98-96. The Clippers now lead this series 2-1. Clippers star Blake Griffin had a game-high 32 points. I mentioned Mike Conley. Well, he had more reason to celebrate. Mike received the NBA Sportsmanship Award, a trophy that's voted on by his fellow players in the league. Conley is the first Grizzlies player to receive the Sportsmanship Award. Congratulations to Mike Conley. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. I love the interview with Lenore. It was really exciting.
She knows her soccer.
Yes, she does.
She really does.
Good for you, Lenore.
Go Wizards.
Yay.
Go Wizards.
All righty. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays like today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, a children's charity in South Sudan, and next, trying to promote peace and harmony in that war-torn country. But first, some music. Here is La Forbes of Lesotho with Spiral Aloe.
Badasukiri kulondi kiamfuti bwidi baleki biesi